Hi, I'm Sarah Cavanaugh, and this is Peaceful Exit. Every episode, we explore death, dying, and grief through stories by authors familiar with the topic. Writers are our translators. They take what is inexpressible, impossible to explain, and they translate it into words on a page. We're doing something different with this episode. We usually talk with authors about death, dying, and grief. And my guests today are Luke Lorenzen and Mati Engel. They're going to discuss their documentary, A Still Small Voice. In the film Luke created, Mati and others dive into the experiences of chaplains during the COVID-19 pandemic. They cover the intense emotional labor of chaplaincy, the impact of burnout, and the human connection in end-of-life care. What is remarkable about this film is that because of COVID-19, all the characters are wearing masks, and you perceive their emotions through their eyes and their body language. It's amazing. Would you mind both sharing just how you came to this project in your thinking about death, and whether this project in interacting with these patients has changed that for you?
I actually remember that I did a mushroom ceremony. You know, it was when COVID began. I was trying to figure out my next steps after graduate school. And while I was, you know, on this psychedelic experience, I felt summoned. Like the movement wasn't away from death, but rather towards it. And it's interesting because like when I think about like now, like what's happening in the world, like I do feel like there's a movement away versus towards that like is coming up again almost. But in that moment, like my body, my sensory experience, my heart, I don't know. I mean, this is a question for what's happening on psychedelic mushrooms. But I was like, let's go towards. That's where we need to go. It felt like the biggest thing that was happening in the world. Like, it was just like, I couldn't even imagine that more world events would happen. That would be potentially more important unraveling. I don't know, morally engaging. But this seemed like the best thing to do with my being. And I couldn't explain it. And so I just listened. It's like the closest thing that I could say I have felt to like a calling. I mean, it sounds like I'm a hippie woo-woo. I'm sorry. It just felt like a calling that kind of we maybe both had in different ways that brought us to the same place, which is, I mean, another level or dimension of just chance, let's say. And I think in terms of the second question you asked is almost like more difficult to answer. I think when you're a chaplain, you're going through so many different encounters, especially full-time, especially as a resident, especially during COVID. Like how much of the encounters do you retain, like both in a memory-wise and then like physically, like your body, I think, stores memory as well, even if like mentally it's harder to access. And so when I think about, you know, if I saw, let's say, 6 to 12 or 6 to 11 patients a day, how much of that do I actually recall? It's hard to say. But I wanted to get as much information sensorily in my body about how people interface with like the end of life or the last scene, if you will. And I think almost some of it was from a creative or artistic perspective of like, maybe even like philosophical, like this is the creative act, the last scene. How much agency do you have? Like, what do people think about? Like, how much bandwidth is there actually to like engage with it? Like as like something that can be acted on. But I'd be curious, Luke, how you would come around on this.
I do feel there was a calling of sorts or some pull towards this subject matter that I think I'm still trying to figure out if fully. What Mati said of like, this is what was happening in the world at this time really resonates with me. And being a filmmaker and looking for my next film and wanting to make something that mattered in this moment where it was so hard to figure out what was happening. I had just come off a film before it that dealt with death in a really different way. It was about a family-run ambulance service in Mexico City. And it was like a car chase thriller. It was like very high adrenaline, interacting with patients in tiny ways, but feeling these tragic moments in their life. And I think there was a part of me that was craving reflection, a space where the questions that couldn't be asked in that space could have a bit of time. But I think even to this day, like framing this film as a story about death makes me really uncomfortable. I think there's a part of me that doesn't want to admit that that's what I was sort of drawn to. And I think much easier ideas of human connection, relationships, walking into the room and putting yourself into somebody else's shoes. These were all sort of ways of thinking that I, as a filmmaker, really wanted to learn. And being with Mati and her cohort was just like a real masterclass for me in terms of those sort of trust building skills. But I think chaplaincy at its core, as I experienced it, was a way to understand some of these bigger human questions of how we relate to one another. And the piece of the film being in these moments of loss, it's hard when that topic is talked about so generally. And I really wanted the film to be really specific about a few people and not try to make some sort of claim about how these processes are done broadly. And that sort of elevated it out of a scary place into a human place of, okay, these are people I interacted with and met and learned from.
It's beautifully represented in the film where everyone is wearing a mask. And I'm thinking about that scene where you're passing around aromatherapy and iced tea and those small human kindnesses, how you represent kindness and communication through the eyes and the body language and the tilt of the head. I mean, there's just some beautiful moments that are quiet. How did you navigate people's emotions so well because they were wearing masks when you can't really see what they're thinking or feeling?
It took a bit of ice breaking.
We talk a lot about caregiver burnout. We saw what that looks like on a daily basis. And you're being asked to hold so much as a chaplain. How did you come to it yourself in terms of the logistics? Like, were you working 5 days a week, 12-hour days? What was the COVID schedule? Because it was a 6-month residency, is that right?
12 months.
Oh, 12 months. Okay.
And I also like to joke that residency is quite literal. Like, there's an element of like really taking residence in the hospital. You know, you have on-call shift. So oftentimes that means that you're required also to give your services like during weekends or evenings. I mean, we would pass it around in terms of like the team and who would take up those on-call shifts, but it wasn't a seamless 9-to-5 necessarily. But yeah, it was 12 months. I was also coming straight away from doing 8 months at Northwestern. So I was in the trenches just at a different hospital. And in New York City, I mean, you're also interfacing with public transit, a busy city, navigating like a move in the US, navigating changes like relationally, like what your support system looks like, at least during, you know, that residency, that was the case for me. So I would add those things as well. But yeah, it was 9-to-5 and then some on-call shifts as well. So that's weekends, evenings.
Feels like facing kind of an impossible task in an impossible medical system.
Yeah.
What about you? You were there for a year.
I was probably in the hospital for like 7 months. And it completely wrecked me. Like, I am still in some ways recovering from it. It was something I think I went into very openly. I had, again, just come off this other project that was really heavy in a different way. And for some reason, that one didn't have this effect on me, or maybe what I was feeling at the end of both was cumulative, but there's something about the work of a chaplain that is so, so heavy. Just on a basic level, being in a space where everybody around you has this sort of weight on their shoulders, patients, all of the employees, it compounds over time. And that's sort of, yeah, what the film is trying to show in a lot of ways. But it was definitely my first experience with sort of ending a project and knowing that there was no other thing to do other than try and slow down. It was the first time in my life where I would like felt a certain like cynicism or sort of doubt if I wanted to keep making films, which was like very disorienting for me. And after some time to just move more slowly, that sort of like love for storytelling has come back, but it's been a journey.
What do you think the role of the witness is? You're a journalist, a documentary filmmaker.
I mean, I think this what is witnessed is paid attention to, and what is paid attention to becomes meaningful. I see my job more and more as paying attention to moments, details, people, stories that others aren't, and delivering it to the world in a way where you can't look away, where you are sort of called to pay attention through the film. It's very powerful stuff to sort of look someone in the eye and pay attention to them. There's nothing like it. And I think when done with the right people in the right ways, documentary filmmaking can sort of offer that light.
Mati, would you have anything to add?
Well, it's interesting because like when people ask me what does a chaplain do or what is chaplaincy, I often revert to like the role of a witness, like almost stripping it of religion. And maybe that's like where I came to with that profession after the burnout that it seems we both experienced pretty intensely. I spent like 2 years in Germany studying collective witnessing as an intervention to both kind of like prevent trauma or disrupt trauma from lodging into the body. And attunement and witnessing and being with, maybe being with would be like this supplication for like witnessing. It's like to be in relation with another person or to have awareness on emotional experience and like processing of an event in your body allows for things to like kind of move as opposed to like lodge inside of you and be stored as memory that can't be processed. And so therefore it remains inside of you as like residual information, and maybe we might even call trauma frozen memory that can't be processed. And so this act of witnessing, it's like, what is love? Love is the quality of attention or attunement. I think that's what we were being led to practice as chaplains. And what I've come to know is like the antidote, or like a part of the antidote, or like the medicine balm for preventing trauma. I've come to just, I guess, accept that trauma is part of all of our lives and experiences, especially in the world that we live in now. And when you have so much information like overload and you're not able to like actually digest or be with the experience, it does a disservice. So I think what we're doing is just like really slowing down and allowing like the information to kind of just like download into the body and like move. So doing that in relationship is quite different than doing that by yourself, meditating.
Let's talk about David for a minute, another character in the film who isn't here for this conversation. Was the crux of that conflict that neither one of you seemed to have gas in the tank? It's another example of what burnout looks like. I had some sympathy for him too, which I know is a deliberate choice. Talk a little bit about that piece of the film.
it was my job to really care about everybody and to get to know everybody and what they were experiencing. And I believe pretty deeply that if you can put yourself in somebody's shoes, it will make sense. And everyone has their reasons for why they feel the way they do and how they act. It's not random. And so with David, it was just the process was sort of figuring out what I needed as a filmmaker to have his part of the story in the film, and really give him credit for welcoming me into those sessions with his supervisor and pulling back the curtain into, you know, what was going on in his head as he was trying to do his job. And it was really important to me that the film didn't have an antagonist or sort of a good side and a bad side, but that it was multiple people struggling with the experience of doing an impossible job and hitting a point of not wanting to keep doing it.
Yeah. It was beautifully done. The revolving empty chair after he just got up and left. The silences in the film were very powerful.
It's so hard to make a hospital quiet. It's, you know, sound design for a film is so often adding sound. And this one, it was mostly taking sound out so that people's voices were lifted and clear and that you weren't hearing just like humming air machines. But it is a quiet film in a way that I think pulls you into the screen. It asks you to also be quiet and sort of pay attention.
It absolutely does. It calls you to pay attention. So what would you two like to talk about in terms of, are there questions that you've been asked in screenings? Are there things that you really want to convey with this film?
My sort of gut reaction is that the film really speaks for itself, and I think people bring their own life experiences to it and see it in sort of so many different ways, and trying to talk about it too much might take that from people. So I love talking about the process of how it was made, and less so the sort of meaning that it has for me.
Yeah. Are there any scenes that you two loved that didn't make it in the film? I remember producing a film that had so many themes in it, so many threads. We kind of had to choose whether it be a climate film or whether it be a crossing difference film, or were there choices you had to leave behind?
Yeah, I shot maybe 500 or 600 hours of footage, and the film's 90 minutes. So it's so much. I think the immediate thing that comes to mind is I filmed with all of the residents in the cohort, and believed for sort of until halfway through the edit that the film was going to tell everybody's story and sort of weave multiple experiences of the residency into one. And it became clear that that was just too much for one film, and that focusing it on Mati was the better sort of cleaner path. And that was a really hard decision for me to let go of that material and to communicate with the others that had put a lot into the film, that this had changed, to communicate with Mati, that she was now a much bigger part of this film than she believed at that moment. So that's the biggest thing that was hard to let go of.
You're nodding.
Yeah, no, I love that question that you asked. I don't think that question has come up yet, so I'm really appreciating the generosity in it. There are three scenes in particular that came to mind when you asked that question. One is like a young kid who was shot in the gut and then had to get a transplant and then an ex-transplant, and just like following them over like a long duration of time, because that's kind of rare with chaplaincy. Like, you rarely have a long-term relationship. It's always mostly short-term. Another is where actually a priest that had a patient call, and I was on call, so I wasn't in the hospital. but I was supporting him like on the phone, and I thought that I was being called to support the patient. And this is the tricky thing with this work. Sometimes you're actually called to support the priest. And the priest was like scolded for walking into the room and kind of felt like just, yeah, the patient had like their bed sheet like all over their body and like was like yelling and like kind of coming at the priest. And I think when he called, it was just like, I could use like just some reinforcement or somebody else in the trenches. And I think that that to me was like just like such an important moment of like, chaplains and priests are people. We're not gods. We're people. And like, we need to be humanized. And if there's anything that this film accomplishes, is it's also that, the shortcomings of being human.
What's it like for you as a chaplain performing rituals from traditions that are not your own? Because I think that baptism scene really stood out to me, and the fact that you were willing to share that you were nervous about performing that.
What immediately comes up is just what I now know being with the film overseas. So being with the film in Germany, I found that that scene has actually been a topic that has come up more often than not. And almost like who gets to perform what ritual? Which I really appreciate as a question and like an observation and maybe even something that gets triggered when watching the film. Yeah, and the last Q&A that I did live was in Berlin, actually. This question came up again, and I think like I've come to a different place with it in a way. Like in the moment, it felt like absolutely the right thing to do. And I do think it was a good thing to do. And we did get like the patient's consent afterwards also. So like they're in terms of being in the film for that scene in particular. But in retrospect, I would say, you know, it's always nice to have somebody who could perform a ritual that comes with the richness and the history of that tradition more specifically. Obviously, there's a depth of knowledge that's lost when you don't come from a certain tradition. And one of the best moments I've had after a Q&A was when a friend of mine who's some relative was a Romanian priest. He said, actually, the baptism, like we put a lot of stress on the patient's name or like the baby's name. And that was just something I didn't know. And that's because like I didn't come from that tradition. And so I think that there's a layer of reflection around like, actually, there is something like quite unique when you're able to offer. And I do think it's a gift to be able to offer a ritual and to be invited into ritual, crossing religious boundaries, and like being invited into another religious world is a gift. And there, I do think that there's something quite profound when you have a certain history or depth of knowledge within a religion. That said, humanism was quite important to me, like in terms of like practicing chaplaincy or practicing religious ritual and just being with, and also navigating like what does a person need. So like if I were to remove the orientation towards the vertical plane, towards like God, and just be on the horizontal, like what does a person need in the moment, I think it was the right thing to do. But on the vertical axis, I don't know, it's definitely a topic for conversation, like theologically. And I think this is a very rich film for that, and that scene in particular, for sure. But also chaplains are asked to do sometimes, not always, multi-faith work. So that sometimes looks like interventions that are rituals and crossing into other domains. I do think there was a part of me that was like, I mean, I come from like a ultra-Orthodox Jewish background. Like I'd probably have grandparents rolling in their graves if they knew I did that. Definitely something to reflect on over the years.
Yeah. Well, I love your intuition to say her name, Aurora, and you said it several times. So clearly that is part of the tradition, even if you learned it later, you know, it was.
Yeah.
It was intuitive, you know.
I'll also just share that it's easy to talk about what's ideal, and chaplaincy is so rarely able to offer what's ideal, but is making something out of a really impossible situation. And in that moment, Mati was available and somebody with a deeper history was not. And what I think was so beautiful about it is her ability to walk in and figure out what was needed.
I'm talking with Luke Lorenzen and Mati Engel. Their movie is A Still Small Voice, and it's available now on Mubi, mubi.com, and also you can find it on Good Docs for private screenings. We will put a link in our show notes. The last question I ask all of my guests, I'd like to ask the both of you, what does a peaceful exit mean to you?
I was going to say, like, you know, life well lived, choices well taken, agency, blah, blah, blah. But I actually think grace, like being visited by grace. I think there's a meeting in between of like yourself, your own actions, your own agency, but then also being met by, one could say, the divine. I don't know, but there are graceful exits for sure.
Thank you.
I would think of a peaceful exit as one full of love. You know, ideally people who have known and cared about me and witnessed my life, but it could be something much simpler than that. Somebody who, like Mati did for many people, is there and caring.
Beautiful. Thank you both so much for your time, and I really appreciate it. It's a beautiful film. I wish it much, much success as it goes out into the world for a broader audience. And I think it's so unique in how it represents a time that some people want to forget, but I think we need to remember and we need to grieve COVID times. It's really important that we don't gloss it over. So thank you.
Thanks so much for your time and for your curiosity about our work and for helping us share it with people.
Thank you for listening to Peaceful Exit. I'm your host, Sarah Cavanaugh. You can learn more about this podcast at peacefulexit.net. And you can find me on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram at A Peaceful Exit. If you enjoyed this episode, please let us know. You can rate and review this show on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. This episode was produced by the amazing team at Large Media. You can find them at larjmedia.com. The Peaceful Exit team includes my producer, Katie Klein, and editor, Corinne Kiltow. Our sound engineer is Sean Simmons. Tina Knoll is our senior producer, and Sid Gladu provides additional production and social media support. Special thanks to Ricardo Russell for the original music throughout this podcast. As always, thanks for listening. I'm Sarah Cavanaugh, and this is Peaceful Exit.